Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello everybody. This is Steve Behrman and welcome to Wiki Politiki. Today we're going to address an issue that's made its way into the headlines and into our heads over the past 2 months. It all began with the sex abuse allegations against Harvey Weinstein. And then the dominoes began to fall. Charlie Rose, Kevin Spacey, Garrison Keillor, Al Franken. Seems like the only abusers left standing are Roy Moore and the Groper-in-Chief himself. Well, we've had the Me Too movement, and that is struck with a vengeance, and maybe vengeance plays a bigger part than we imagine. After all, media titillation works both ways. There's parts of us, I think, that enjoy a juicy scandal, and then there's the other part that vicariously gets off on punishing the perpetrator or the suspected perpetrator. So Harvey Weinstein obviously uses power and physical brutality even to overpower and perhaps rape women. Well, what about Al Franken? What about Garrison Keillor? And why do fundamentalist Republicans support Roy Moore and Donald Trump despite or possibly because of the allegations? Most importantly of all, how do we heal this rift between the sexes and use it as a learning moment and a dynamo to move our civilization forward into greater awareness and connection? Our guest today is going to help us unpack this bag of trash and trash talk, unravel the yarn, and point us in the direction of healing, which means restoring wholeness. Veronica Monet is an author. She's a coach and a counselor. Her website's called The Shame-Free Zone. She is a rape and incest survivor, and she changed or abandoned several careers because of sexual harassment. She's a certified rape counselor, sexologist, and relationship coach, and the creator of what she calls the Exquisite Partnership Formula. So welcome, Veronica.
Hey, I'm really glad to be here, Steve, and this is one hot topic, isn't it? It's just hitting the news every day.
Yeah, there's something new every day, something new every day. And I think a lot of people are kind of taken by surprise and confused by it. Before we get into the topic about hashtag Me Too and all of these other issues, let's talk about your own history and what brings you to this topic and the realizations that you've had that give you a unique perspective.
Well, first of all, I think my history as a sexual abuse survivor and somebody whose career was shaped by sexual harassment on the job doesn't really make me all that unique. I think it's kind of a normal thing that most women go through. Every woman I talk to is just kind of like going, yep, that was my life as well. So not everybody is going on the media and saying Me Too. And I've had friends who are telling me they're intentionally not tweeting the hashtag Me Too because they want to keep that part of their life private. But I don't think we should allow that to lull us into a false sense of security. This is a huge thing. It's really a huge thing for women. And so in that sense, I'm just a normal, average woman who's experienced some sort of sexual harassment and assault. The fact that I'm a rape survivor might put me in the minority, but it gives me also, I think, an opportunity to address, so this is perhaps where the unique perspective can come in, what are the differences, or are there any differences between the various different sexual predations that are being discussed currently? So it seems like right now we've kind of got a conflation between assault, unwanted advances, rape, coercion. Sorting that out just seems like it's become a bit of a task that we're not even really taking on right now. And there's actually a good reason for that, and it's also counterproductive. So I really can't wait to get into that. But, I mean, I hope that gives you some idea. Yes, I've got training as a rape counselor, and I have really spent the bulk of my life trying to dispel shame, heal shame, and move people away from shame. And in a lot of ways, I see our current crisis, if you want to call it that, having everything to do with the sexual shame that really defines our current culture. So there's this way in which men and women can't really talk about their different perspectives because we don't talk about sex, not in an open, frank way. And as a sex educator, I'm all about helping people to have those conversations. So,
well, let's, before we get into this, the specific things about shame and about how shame and sexuality have been intertwined, why has this happened now? The current spate of revelations and resignations, why this and why now?
You know, I was not at the Women's March in D.C., but I was at the Women's March we had in Sacramento, California. It was a really inspiring moment. Women were showing up en masse because I think we were very, very frustrated with Trump's election. And for some women, that actually crossed party lines. You know, I want to just remind all of us here that Trump did not win the majority vote. So there were plenty of people from the Republican side of the aisle who also did not want to see this man who had admitted to grabbing women's genitals without their permission, elected into the highest office in not only our country, but really in the world. And I think women just felt almost maybe a little bit of helplessness in that moment that, oh my God, how did this happen? How did a man who's been accused of and has even admitted to some forms of sexual assault publicly wind up being the President of the United States? So the Women's March became an expression of that outrage. And then after the Women's March, there formed various different political groups, Indivisible, for instance, which I'm a member of, which really started trying to take activism to the next level. And if you've noticed a lot of those town hall meetings where the lawmakers were getting a blast from the constituents, almost all those people in those town hall meetings were women. By and large, there's just been a real groundswell of women getting very active in trying to change the government and change the laws. So this, to me, this Me Too movement becomes an extension of that. It's kind of the natural next step. We go from the Women's March to Indivisible and various other political action groups, and now we've got Me Too. And I think it's an expression of the fact that women are just not going to put up with this anymore.
And so Harvey Weinstein was the first domino to fall. Any reflections on why him, why that, and why that happened at this particular time?
Well, I think his perpetrations are incredibly severe. And that you know, if we're reaching this critical mass where women can no longer remain silent, which I think is happening, the people who have committed the worst offenses are probably going to be called out first. And certainly Harvey Weinstein has done some horrible things, and his abuse of power is blatant. I mean, you really, I think there's probably nobody that's actually trying to find an explanation for him or an excuse for him. And I think that's probably why it was the first one to go. But there's a way in which women who were in denial about their own discomfort and their personal derailment of their career have come out of denial, have become aware of just exactly how much impact sexual harassment has had on them personally. And I can tell you something. I've been working with my issues around being sexually perpetrated against for 30 years. But there were ways in which I hadn't fully connected to how my brush with Hollywood sent me packing. How the fact that a Hollywood producer made it quite explicit that if I wanted to be an actress, I was going to have to sleep with him, actually caused me not to want to be an actress. Now, I don't have a huge bunch of grief about that. I went on to have a career doing other things, working for myself in ways that really fulfill me, and as a coach and author, I'm probably a far more fulfilled. But going back to that moment and realizing, wow, you know what? Me too.
Yeah, you too.
Me too. And I think that's happening to a lot of women. And it starts in Hollywood after the Weinstein disclosure, and then after a while it really starts picking up momentum and women are starting to go, no, it's also in this line of work and that line of work. It's in all professions. Anywhere where men and women work together.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And I've been here, you know, again, so many of these stories have been coming out. And as a guy, you know, I've had to go back and reflect on, you know, how have I behaved? You know, what has been appropriate and inappropriate? I've never done anything to physically, you know, force myself on anybody or, you know, expose myself or anything like that. But, you know, this is, you know, as you will, I'm sure, you understand, you know, these are powerful, energetic forces that we have, you know, and, you know, it used to be that they were, you know, managed by repressing them from the top, and that didn't really manage them either. So I'm curious as to, you know, now that you mentioned Harvey Weinstein, and earlier you mentioned some of these other people, you know, where do the where does Garrison Keillor, for goodness sakes, fit in, or Al Franken, and so on? And what about that?
So a conversation about nuancing sexual harassment versus assault versus rape really has to be approached from a place that may not be intuitive to all of us. And the first thing that I want to say, as both a survivor and a rape counselor, it's essential that when we're dealing with women who have been sexually perpetrated against, that we don't compare pain. And this is to the credit of the Me Too movement. We're not doing that right now, and I think it's really an important first step. We're really honoring all women's pain. So if she felt pressured or she felt uncomfortable, that has just as much value as if she was raped by the definition, and it's a rather limited definition that the law provides.
And yeah, go ahead.
So I just really want that to preface this discussion, because it's an essential component of this, and really, I see my job, if you will, is trying to weave together the disparate realities that men and women are experiencing in sexually, culturally, and in this particular cultural crisis. We are not having the same experience, we're not having the same perspective, and then, of course, I'm making a generalization there based on gender, and the truth is that people of any gender can disagree on this, but to at least give voice to why the Me Too movement is being so inclusive and including all forms of sexual perpetration, it's just really important to understand that we're not wanting to compare pain. So in other words, if we once we start to nuance this conversation, we risk tipping over into a place where we can say, well, it wasn't that bad, so why are you complaining about it?
Mm-hmm.
And that points to the first point that I want to make about the way boys and girls are raised, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is really why men and women can't understand each other on this particular topic, or why we're having difficulty doing so. I think we can, but we need a lot of help getting there. So if boys are taught not to really fully connect with their own emotions, there's a way in which we're tamping down their ability to be empathetic to themselves and therefore to others, because empathy starts in self. You have to have empathy for yourself before you can express empathy for somebody else. And if co-committed with that, not only are we lacking empathy for self and for others, but one's whole identity is wrapped up in initiating action and controlling outcomes. So if you're male identified, you're probably going to be very invested in controlling yourself and the people around you. This becomes how you accrue some type of power. And initiating, creating action, creating outcomes is how you prove yourself as a man. It's also what our sexual courting is, the whole system around flirting, dating is often predicated, and I'm not speaking about millennials right now, I'm speaking about all the generations that precede millennials, which is mostly what we're looking at right now in all these cases. I think millennials have already started to develop a very different value system around dating or hooking up, since a lot of them don't even date. But for those of us that were born before the millennial era, there's still a lot of pressure put on men to initiate that first kiss, for instance, or to ask a woman out on a date, or to show some kind of interest. And Meredith Chivers, she's a researcher out of Canada a few years back, came out with a survey that showed that almost every adult woman's secret fantasy was of a man who forcefully and artfully gave her that first kiss. And actually, some of the fantasies involved being pushed up against the wall and kissed forcefully.
So okay, wow. We're going to hold that thought for just a second, Veronica. We can until we come back after this break. Fascinating idea. We'll be talking with Veronica Monet when we get back.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Imagine, it is the year 2039. A single corporation controls most of the world through genetic modification, food, and drugs. A senior geneticist's lover dies, launching him on a quest to take down the psychopathic CEO and the handful of elite families that control the corporation. The feature film Corporate Prey, based on the novel of the same name, points us toward a dystopian future where we seem to be headed. Huge corporations do largely control our farms and our pharma. And wealthy elites seem to be operating to the detriment of most humans. Can we reverse course Can prophecy lead to prevention? Can a movie awaken enough of us in time? To find out more and how you can help bring this enlightening film to light, go to corporatepray.com. Corporate Pray. That's P-R-E-Y.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
In the wake of a hurricane, your monetary donation can make a huge difference to those in need. To donate, visit supporthurricanerelief.org. That's supporthurricanerelief.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, we're back with Veronica Monet, that we interrupted you in mid-thought in regards to how boys are raised, how girls are raised. So why don't you continue with that and complete that idea?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I wanted to also talk about girls. So girls are taught in a lot of ways to kind of go along, to get along. So there's this way in which, you know, they are supposed to be a little less active, more silent, more congenial. And if somebody suggests an idea, kind of try to find what's good about it, or don't mock it, don't make fun of it. So, and again, I want to stress, I'm talking about certain generations here. I'm not talking about millennials. They do have a different culture, but we're not hearing about that in the news so much right now. Although, I do want to say that I think millennials are kind of pushing us towards this new paradigm. So that's a really important thing to consider as well. But for the vast majority of the players in the scenarios that are going back 30, 40 years, we're talking about generations that were raised with kind of some stereotypical ideas about boys and girls, where boys initiate sex and girls either reject it or they accept it. And a lot of the fantasies that women have had centered on a man who knew how to initiate sex. Once again, with the emphasis on him taking the lead. So I kind of feel like we're in this place right now when we're talking about some of the things that are being called harassment that don't actually constitute assault. Some of them are blatant efforts to coerce. When I think about Matt Lauer, for instance, from the Today Show, having a button in his office that locks the door so that whoever comes into his office can't get out, that's a rape tactic you would expect from a really hardened sexual perpetrator. So, but then when you're talking about some of these other things, like a hand on a bare back, in an effort to kind of comfort someone. I know David Korn from Mother Jones was being investigated for sexual impropriety in the office place because sometimes he massaged people's shoulders and they didn't want him to touch them. It feels to me like we're tipping over into an area where we maybe want to start looking at how women can assert their boundaries more successfully too. So I guess when I look at this, I see an educational process that needs to take place on both sides of the gender divide, so that we're not just teaching men about what is it that is overstepping the bounds in work or at college. And by the way, there's different laws that apply to that. Title VII applies to the workplace and Title IX applies to the college. But also in our personal lives. How do we, as men and women who want to perhaps have sex with each other and date each other, relate to each other in ways that aren't going to foster misunderstanding? And one of the things that I think is really coming out now is how many times some men might actually think they're engaging in something that's consensual or desirable, and they find out that the woman that they were giving their attentions to was highly offended, felt cornered and victimized, and didn't know how to say or do whatever she needed to do to get herself out of that situation. Obviously, when we start talking about the workplace, it's a different kettle of fish. And I read one woman's article where she was talking about, oh, well, I met my husband at work. He was my employer, and he made the move on me. We got drunk, and he kissed me, and now we're married. 14 years later, we're very happy. And I'm like, well, that's good. I'm glad that worked out for you. But the fact remains that any kind of sexual advance in the workplace is going to communicate to a woman, at least, an inequity in power. And because of the training that sometimes comes with, you know, growing up as a female, there can be an inability to know how to speak out against that. And then there's just a fear. For the vast majority of women, speaking out about sexual harassment in the workplace means you're going to either get terminated or passed up for a promotion or otherwise slut-shamed and cut out of the corporate culture so that you can't make the connections that you need to make.
So
I know
it's to get along. No, you actually, there's a lot in there, and the go along to get along. It's not just that, of course, because over the generations, women have learned ways to play that system, right? In a certain regard, so it becomes in a certain regard, there is while there are unwelcomed advances. And men are kind of expected to initiate, just like the woman who said, well, that's how I met my husband, and I'm perfectly happy with that. You know, part of it is a mixed message that's being delivered and received because of how girls have been trained. Does that
make
sense?
Steve, I understand what you're saying, and it points to an old argument that's been in the culture for quite some time, which is that the woman teased or led on the perpetrator. Let me respond to that as a bisexual woman who has dated and made the first move on women that I was interested in sexually. And I can honestly tell you that I would be very shocked if any of them came forward and accused me of sexual harassment. I think I'm pretty sensitive to that topic as somebody who has been sexually harassed. So I don't think that really explains it. Have I ever been played by a woman who enjoyed my attentions and really had no serious intention of going out with me? Yes, absolutely. I can think of a couple instances where it was very frustrating and demoralizing, and I can empathize fully with men who have had that game played on them. But never once did that legitimize or in any way make me feel entitled to somehow or another overstep the bounds of seeking full consent. And I think
exactly. That
because we have confusion about what consent looks like, we can start to conflate those two issues. Yes, sure. Some people of any gender enjoy having an enormous amount of sexual attention and don't have any desire to follow up on that attention. They just like getting the attention. But I personally don't think that's abuse. As a matter of fact, when I'm working with women who feel guilty because some guy became sexually aroused in her presence, and then suddenly feels obligated to perform some kind of a sex act because she feels responsible for his arousal, I disavow them of that assumption very quickly and tell them that if he's aroused, you can simply say, you're welcome, and walk away. Because there's
yeah. Well, that, yeah,
see,
you're welcome. That's a good...
That is, you're welcome. You're welcome, and goodbye. Because, but, see, that to me is a more empowered view of if, let's say, someone of any gender were to cause in me some sexual arousal, that doesn't give me access to them. And unfortunately, embedded in our cultural roots that go back millennia, it's this idea of slut shaming. So we blame a woman who might, her presence, in whatever form, whatever, because something she's wearing, something she said, something she did, or just her proximity, her age, whatever, it has varied down through the ages, but the onus is always on the woman that somehow or another she precipitated that, and so it's her fault. And we absolutely are so beyond that old paradigm at this point.
Well, and it still asserts itself, as you've indicated. I'd like to get into the shame issue, because I think there's a lot there. Yeah, there is some provocative statement made by, the psychologist, Gilligan. Say more about shame and how that operates to our detriment and how it figures into this particular conversation.
Oh, it's huge right now, isn't it? I think about the way that the town square used to be a place where they'd put the stocks and people who had violated the community standards would be put into those stocks, and then people would go by and pelt them with rotten tomatoes or tickle their feet and hurl verbal assaults towards them in order to try to teach them not to deviate from the community standards. That's shaming. That's what that is. It's shaming. And it can have the effect of causing people to become very paranoid about their behavior or very vigilant about their behavior. But it also tends to result in re-perpetration. So, for instance, if we sexually shame somebody as a child because maybe their parents walked in on them masturbating, and then thoroughly shame them about that, we risk that person actually turning towards some sexual behaviors that might be very frustrating for them and possibly non-consensual for other people. So I want to be careful in the terminology that I use, but it can lead to people's sexuality becoming rather warped and dysfunctional. So shaming almost always leads to violence. That's James Gilligan's premise, that shame leads to violence. And whether we're aware of it or not, sexual perpetration is a form of violence. Now, some of the sexual perpetration that we are hearing about may not take a form that the law recognizes as being violent because it doesn't actually cross the threshold of being an assault. And some of it is. Some of it is assault. It's prosecutable. Kevin Spacey right now is being investigated for rape charges in London. But some of this stuff, like putting a hand on the back or asking somebody to have sex with you, is not technically an assault. However, if you happen to be in a position of authority, if you're creating an atmosphere of fear, then on some level it is violence because it's a perpetration. We are operating in an area where this person doesn't really have a lot of free will choice. They don't have a lot of options available to them. And that's one of the reasons that the law recognized that sexual harassment had to be prosecuted. And that's why the companies are so vigilant about dismissing all of these men who have been accused. But if our culture continues, if we persist in what I'm considering a shame fest, which is that we're calling out the perpetrators, and that's where we stop. We just stop at calling them out and then completely ruining their careers and eviscerating them as human beings, and then basically sending that out as a warning to all the other men on the planet, don't you dare step out of line because this could happen to you. Then we've created a culture of shame and fear, and that will never lead to the kind of empathy and healing that we need in order for all of us to thrive. So while I don't have much sympathy for the woman who has been married to her boss now for 14 years, I don't appreciate her her premise that somehow or another we should all just learn how to say no to our bosses, because she's not taking into consideration all the women and men, frankly. Because let's not forget Terry Crews. He's an NFL player who came out against Adam Vinay, his agent, who sexually molested him at a party. And I think Terry Crews has been incredibly brave as a man, as a black man, to come out and say, I was frightened, and I wanted to hit him, but my wife warned me I shouldn't hit him. So then what I was left with was all my feelings of humiliation and that this man's very powerful and I don't have a lot of recourse. And that really yep. is true. But we can't handle it with shame. Empathy for both sides is where I go because, of course, I'm a relationship coach. So I'm all about trying to get us connected at the heart empathetically. And I have a hard line on sexual perpetration, but I don't have a need to shame the sexual perpetrator. I think we can heal these individuals, and I think we can heal our culture so that it's not so prevalent. And we can't do that if we keep shaming, because we're just going to drive it underground, and I think the problem will become worse because of it.
Well, it's probably why there's such a reaction against all of this by the right wing, who, they seem to embrace the perpetrators, unless, of course, they're Democrats. Do you see a relationship sure. between that defensiveness and the potential for shaming?
Well,
or is there another reason behind it?
It's complex. So let's tease this out. The conservative mindset is basically that it's not really a perpetration. When they're calling out the perpetrators on the left, they're calling out what they consider hypocrisy. So I don't think they're yes. actually thinking, sexual perpetration is a bad thing, and we consider that sexual perpetration, and that shouldn't happen. I think the attitude is, hey, in Alabama, we were marrying our girls off at a very young age, and they were all dating at a young age. And so, what's the big deal with Roy Moore? And
exactly.
as far as Trump's, the type of assault that we got to go, don't we?
Yeah, we got to. We'll be back, leaving us right hanging with Donald. We don't want to leave Donald Trump hanging, do we?
Okay.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential, so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
I rescued Toast from a shelter in 2011. I love Toast because she's a lazy diva. Toast does whatever she wants, obviously. She's sleeping right now. She's so loving. She's so comforting. When I walked into the shelter, I knew right then that she was special.
Toast, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Start yours today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
All Okay, we left Donald Trump hanging there. So let's complete the thought about Donald Trump. And incidentally, we had, you know, five Democrat U.S. senators call for his resignation because of these accusations by 17 women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you're saying, well, it pretty much plays into their narrative. There's no problem with that. So say more about that, and then I'd like to move on to your wrap up.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so I was raised by the religious right. I was raised in a right-wing doomsday Christian cult. My grandmother, grandmother was an Assembly of God member, very devout. My other grandmother was a Mormon. And they're all Trump supporters. my mother told me, she said, Trump wants to help the immigrants. So I know something about at least my family of origin and why they support Trump. And in a lot of ways, he is cut from the same patriarchal cloth as their religious leaders and even their husbands. So trying to get my mother to be outraged about Trump's improprieties is kind of a no-win situation, because she married somebody who was a sexual perpetrator. That was my father. He molested both my sister and I. Her grandfather molested her mother. It was just kind of the soup that she grew up in, so she doesn't have a lot of a radar for that. And in fact, she's been trained to blame women for anything that happens to them and to legitimize and excuse whatever men do, as if they're doing the best they can. So do I think that speaks to all Republicans and all conservatives? Of course not. But unfortunately, I would have to say that I think there's a way in which it just doesn't rank very high as something that they want to address. And I recently, Trevor Noah put out a show, and his title of it was, Do the Republicans Even Care About Sexual Harassment and Sexual Assault? And that's a good question. I'm wondering if they do or not. Doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, and it's also, it's perhaps, as you mentioned, with the millennials having different values entirely, that, you know, this may get outgrown after a particular time. But as for now, if you were to offer a general prescription for the Me Too movement and for the men who have been accused, or men who are going, my God, am I going to be accused? What have I done? Who are either on that cusp between being defensive and being open to really understanding what this is all about. And I think you've really made a lot of clarifying statements about what this really is all about. What would your prescription be for how to proceed from here?
Well, the next thing that we need to do is really start having conversations. I'm going to be launching some support groups here in my own community to help men and women coming together to have these conversations about their different perspectives, because I think we need to learn how to listen to each other and to hear each other. Right now we're having a one-way conversation, and I understand it. Women are sick and tired. They've been, basically silenced, and now they're speaking out. But I want men to also get involved in it, not through power politics, not through going back to silencing women or blaming women, but actually learning how to have empathy for themselves and for women. And that calls for something of a cultural shift, because the next step really is going to require us to move past anything that smacks of, blaming the victim or shaming the perpetrator. These are like the only two channels we seem to have right now, if we blame the victim or we shame the perpetrator. And it's not really such a hard thing to learn to have compassion for and empathy for perpetrators while asserting healthy boundaries. I've had to learn that myself in having a family full of pedophiles. How do I love those people and at the same time protect myself and my children from them? How do I have healthy boundaries to keep me safe? How do I speak truth to lies? How do I correct the injustice? And at the same time, not start demonizing the human beings that are involved in this. Because perpetrators are human beings too. And there is a lot of fear among men. I'm getting emails almost every day from people who are like men who are worried. Am I a perpetrator? How would I know if I'm a perpetrator? So I think we really need to start having those conversations. We need to have conversations about what does consent look like? Because that's still very controversial. Some of the universities that have been, doing consent, institutionalizing that on campus, have been accused of being too stringent and removing the mystique from flirting and dating. And so I'm going to be doing support groups to explore that. What is the difference between flirting and harassing someone?
That is a very interesting distinction, yes.
Yes, it is. And it's going to look different for a lot of different people. But I think first and foremost, we've got to start actually kind of connecting to each other empathetically and intuitively. And unfortunately, Steve, I'm here to tell you, the male culture doesn't allow for a lot of empathetic, intuitive connection. So
yes, it really limits the options of men, very much so, yes.
Yeah, so I want to see us reaching out to men who have sexually harassed and sexually perpetrated and start educating them, because some of these people are educatable. They really are. I don't think that if you take somebody like Garrison Keillor or even Dustin Hoffman, I think some of these people, and certainly Al Franken, I think they would rather engage the conversation. But you know, when we shame people, their defenses are going to go up, and they won't learn anything, and we won't either.
So this is really very interesting, because that brings us to the topic of punishment. I've always been a fan of truth and reconciliation as a way of actually clearing the clearing. It did work to a certain extent in South Africa 20 or 25 years ago, where essentially the pleasure, and I put quote marks around pleasure, of punishing somebody for something that they did, the retribution, they deserve it, gets replaced by this opportunity for compassion and compassion for self, and it takes us out of the shame and blame cycle. So how can we deal with this? I mean, what is a punishment? How does punishment fit in? Like losing your career, for as an example. We could look at Garrison Keillor and Al Franken and some of the younger people, Matt Lauer and so on. They've lost their careers. So is that appropriate? And what do you think? Is that appropriate? Is there some other way? Is there a way to use an old term, penitence, rather than putting them in the penitentiary?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're going to kind of have to go back to one of your earlier questions about how do we sort out the various different perpetrations? How do we nuance this conversation? So if somebody has actually committed an act of rape, let's say Kevin Spacey actually raped a teenage boy, if that turns out that the United Kingdom, or I think it's the London police that are investigating that, if they find reasonable reason to prosecute for that, then absolutely he should go to jail. I think some of the things that Harvey Weinstein has been accused of are very possibly offenses that could put him in jail as well. But then we have other laws. So we've got Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which applies to sexual harassment in the workplace. And the companies that employ have to follow that particular mandate. So So in a lot of ways, they don't have a lot of discretion. It's kind of incumbent upon them to let people go so that they don't actually have to worry about getting sued, and so that they're compliant with the law. But obviously, there does seem to be something of a frenzy right now where we're so worried about the litigation that we're not, and public opinion, that we're not really fully investigating. So almost anybody can make any claim they want. And one wonders what kind of standards are each one of these companies applying before they didn't dismiss somebody. In most of the cases, it seems like there were multiple accusers. And so I think the companies were probably justified. Al Franken doesn't work for a company. He works for the people that elected him. He doesn't have to resign if he doesn't want to. It's not the law. But his party decided that that was in their party's best interest. I personally happen to disagree. I hear now that there are 7 or 8 accusers, but mostly what I've heard has sounded pretty awkward. And I'm going to have to investigate each one of those accusations in more detail. So if somebody out there knows that he's actually done some kind of groping or threatening somebody's career, I know one person tweeting accused him of saying it's my right as an entertainer. But I don't know how much power he actually had over her since she wasn't working for him. So each one of these things kind of has to be taken on an individual basis. And again, I want to stress that regardless of how the law applies and regardless of whether the employer needs to dismiss that person or not, there's two things we have to track here. One is the fact that we want to validate the victim's experience and pain. Okay? And then the other two is, how do we shift? How do we make a sea change so that sexual perpetration becomes less common in male culture? And that isn't going to be accomplished by our two most popular tropes, which is either shaming them or telling them that they need to treat women with more respect. Treat women with more respect. That's what we've been telling men forever. That really has gotten us to where we're at right now. So we're going to have to be more curious and more creative if we want to create something new.
You know, I think that's really, really important. And what you mentioned earlier, which seems like a very perhaps the most simple thing that people can do in their own lives, is to create conversations. And I'm just curious that in your work, as you're starting some groups and so on, whether you have, whether you're developing guidelines for these kinds of conversations so that people are steered away from the shame blame cycle and actually get to listen, to understand and speak, to be heard in relation to their own experience, both men and women.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, your listeners should find my guide. It's called the Exquisite Partnership Formula. And that is a 5-step process for being able to assert a no, assert a boundary, and at the same time create heart connection. The guide actually contains several different methods for creating an ability to hear each other. So, you know, one of the first things we have to do is we have to become curious instead of fearful. We have to really show up with our feelings instead of accusations. We have to be able to listen, and that can only happen in an environment where we are assured of our right to speak and be heard. So right now, women are not really listening because they haven't been heard. They really are needing to be heard. And I get that. And there's a lot of ways in which I am celebrating this Me Too movement. I really am. But I only see it as a beginning. It can't be our end point because as an end point, this is very destructive to all of us. But right now, it's that righteous anger that is moving the culture forward. And it had to happen. It really did. So next we need to start. We're moving towards curiosity and compassion so that we can understand each other. And from what I know about the gender discrepancies, there's human beings on both sides who are having very different experiences. And I want us to start having conversations about that, not to excuse, not to in any way take away the severity of the harassment, the assaults, and the perpetrations, but rather to move towards change. And we can only do that change if we have compassion for the people that we want to change. If we're wagging an accusing finger at them, we will drive their anger underground, and it's going to come out in other ways. And that's one thing I just want to keep in mind here. The sexual perpetration is a form of anger and frustration. Okay? It's never been about the sex. And even for somebody who is perpetrating sexually and may think it's about the sex, it's not. It's not really about the sex. It's about violence and anger.
Wow.
And control and dominance.
What a conversation. Thank you, Veronica Monet. You've really created a lot of space for people to think about this differently. I hope that people contact you at your website. We have it on our WikiPolitiki page. Thank you, Veronica Monet. Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. Till next week.
It was